Dunkin' Donuts iced coffee is America's iced coffee. It's rich, smooth, always freshly brewed. Dunkin' has all the flavors you love. Also available in butter pecan and new coconut cream pie iced coffee flavors. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer. Dunkin' Donuts new fruited iced teas are made with real fruit juice and fruit pieces. Try a mango, pineapple, or blackberry today. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer.
Blog Talk Radio.
And this is Betty Davis, and you are listening to Ralph Pointer, What's Happening. And before we go to our brother, we want to give a special shout-out to our sister Ann, our brother Larry, our brother Tom, brother Shoneman, and of course, our poet, Raymond Nat Turner. And this April, he will be performing for those of you who live in New York City. Without further ado, I would like to turn the mic over to our brother Ralph, but first I want to crow a little bit. I want to say we warned you that the health care crisis in America would be the undoing of the Republican Party as with the Democratic Party. And we still ask the question, will Trump be able to bring together the anti-Zionists with the Zionist perspective and opinions in this country? And we want to remind you that an analysis of oppression requires an analysis of capitalism and the economic underpinnings, because without economic rights, you have no social rights. And without further ado, here is Brother Ralph Pointer.
Thank you for that, Betty. I'm still a little rough in terms of our program. I have memories of programs before and of actions, etc. And I'm still missing our sister Lynn Stewart. But to continue, what I believe, the overriding element in every situation or circumstance in a black life is racism. Birth, elementary school, housing, health, food, etc. Black lives have never mattered except during slavery and other circumstances where money is being made by our labors for others. The modern death penalty, 80% black, moved lynching indoors. The police, as the army of occupation, have taken lynching outside again. And the lynch mob is the racist system, including the courts and the media. And because the lives of our heroes and sheroes, who once protected us in our community, do not matter to us, the people, our political prisoners are now dying in captivity. They are tortured and isolated. Only armed struggle can recreate our image in our own minds as well as the minds of others. Wake up, now is the time. And so the struggle continues and the questions continue. The constant question of what way forward? What policy or policies must we organize together on? How do we fight the government immigration policies? How do we fight together or organize together on old issues, race, sex, and class? And must we name the theory of resistance or clarify the policy in terms of government regulations we support or resist? That is, Social Security, single-payer health care, political prisoners, immigration, education. And one of the things we come to, defiance of federal law, and that is the defiance of the federal law on immigration by municipalities and states. That is, when people in various municipalities defy Trump's immigration policy, when they defy ICE, and when we get unions to work together to defy ICE, we will have something similar to the Dred Scott situation, where the government passed the law, but the law was not enforceable. And we see communities like New Haven, Austin, communities like that who have said no to Mr. Trump and his immigration policy. We look to have other communities follow. And as our sister Lynn Stewart stated before she transitioned, Trump has created a target that we couldn't have under Mr. Obama, because Mr. Obama had too many Teflon paths to follow. Color was one of them. His smooth lies were other things. The Democratic Party lying, it made him Teflon, and we couldn't deal with it. And we didn't deal with it, not for 8 years. And as we stated on this program many times, Trump was merely talking about it in his run-up to the president, in his campaign, what Obama had already done. And so we couldn't get too upset about Mr. Trump. But now, as Lynn Stewart said, we must be passionate and inclusive about solidarity on the issues we wish to define and direct America towards. Compassionate, passionate about solidarity on these issues. And the issues are very obvious. The issue of immigration, we must have recognition of citizenship for all immediately. Recognition of citizenship for all immediately. I feel strange in saying that for one reason, because corporate wealth is built on cheap labor, and we know with immigration, with immigrants, they look to use immigrants as cheap labor. Chinatown, etc., all over this country, cheap labor is one of the secrets to the success of the corporate juggernaut that is crushing us all. And rather than continue, I will hold back on some of the letters that were sent to me on behalf of my hour losing of Lynn Stewart. I will let others speak on that and other issues, because I have gone over my time. And because Sister Lynn is gone, and I just love to be reminded, this is a personal thing, of the way she used poetry to educate us. So I'm going to ask our poet, to give us a poem that will help us learn and remind us of how poetry is involved, how art and culture is involved in the struggle. Are you there?
Can you hear me?
Except there's static there. I don't know what's happening. I can't hear it. The static is too much. I don't know what is with your phone.
A lot of static.
Okay, maybe I'm trying to use the computer, so maybe I can just go back.
Can't understand you.
Let me skip over you and go.
Okay.
I'm going to close your mic. I don't know what's causing it. And let's skip over Raymond Nat Turner and go to Larry Pinckney. Larry, are you there?
Yes, I am. I'm definitely here, brother. And my greetings and salutations to you and to Sister Betty Davis, Sister Professor Betty Davis, and all of the wonderful individuals that will be on the show, the program, collectively this evening. Let me begin by saluting always, not just for this show, but for every show, our sister, Lynn Stewart. You know, a luta continua, the struggle continues. And speaking of poetry, what went through my mind was the poem by Brother Hughes, Langston Hughes, What Happens to a Dream Deferred. The last sentence of that poem, of course, is the most powerful in my mind. Or does it explode? What happens to a dream deferred? We have allowed for too long for the dream of all people, black, white, brown, red, and yellow, we have allowed the dream to be deferred. We have allowed the dream to be deferred. Let's be honest, okay? And yes, we are up against formidable powers, but unfortunately, too many are complicit, too many who look like us, all of us, black, white, brown, red, and yellow, too many people, including black people, black Americans, are complicit in the destruction of our values, our culture, and as Sister Betty Davis said earlier, without economic justice, there is no justice. You can't have social justice. I was so glad, Sister Betty, that you said that, because people, all of us, really need to understand that. Let me go to the very thing that I'm always harping on, that all of us continually refer to, and that is our political prisoners. Our political prisoners. Sister Betty and I had spoken earlier. I had sent Sister Betty, and you too, Brother Ralph, an interview by John Pilger of Julian Assange of WikiLeaks. One of the things that was very interesting among many in that interview, in fact, it was a set of interviews, and one of the things that was most interesting was Assange made it crystal clear that there are, in fact, quote, political prisoners in the United States. He said, sure, other countries have political prisoners, but somehow the United States is left out, when in point of fact, the United States has many political prisoners. He said this from within the embassy of Ecuador in London, England, where, of course, he has been for many years now, basically held hostage, not by the Ecuadorian government, but by Britain, by Sweden, and by the United States. But it was an excellent and powerful, powerful interview, and I had to go back and actually look at it again. I said, my God, did he actually say that? Yes, he did. This is something that, as we all know, we have all been constantly referring to, and that is the plight of political prisoners. And we're talking about political prisoners right here in this so-called bastion of democracy, so-called, the United States of America. So I'm not going to be long-winded. I always try to keep it short. I want to give everybody else a chance. I think it is imperative that we stay the course, that we keep our eyes on the prize, that we not let our dream be deferred. We not let it be deferred. And that other great poem by Langston Hughes, "Let America Be America Again." If you hadn't read the poem, look it up and read it. It'll bring chills to you. So, having said these things, I'm not going to go on. I want to thank everyone in advance for our participation. Much love to Sister Lynn, because I know her spirit is with us. I know that. We all know that. It's painful that she may not be with us physically, but Lynn is with us to remember that, and we must carry on. A luta continua. The struggle continues. All power to the people. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for that, Larry. And next we're going to go to Ralph Schoenman in California and hear what he has to say about what's happening today. Ralph, are you there?
With you, good to be with you, Betty and Brother Pinckney. I was struck by the fact that you began by discussing the health bill's defeat to Medicaid comes of age, which is the subject of an article, Ralph, in today's New York Times, which is quite revealing, because the article delineates how when Medicaid was first implemented, the New York Times did not even mention the fact. It was considered to be a small program to cover poor people's medical bills. But in 5 decades, Medicaid, the Times says, has surpassed Medicare in the number of Americans it covers. It has grown into a behemoth that provides for the medical needs of 1 in 5 Americans, 74 million people, starting for many in the womb, and for others ending only when they go to their graves. Medicaid, it says, so central to the country's healthcare system, played a major, though far less appreciated role in last week's collapse of the Republican drive to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare. While Trump and others blame the Conservative Freedom Caucus for that failure, the objections of most Republicans to the deep cuts in Medicaid helped doom the Republican bill. Quote, "I was not willing to gamble with the care of my constituents with this huge unknown," said Representative Frank A. Lobiondo of New Jersey, a member of the Tuesday Group caucus, noting that in 3 of the counties in his district in the state's southern half, 30% of all residents depend on Medicaid. In the Senate, Republicans echoing their state governors had worried about jeopardizing the treatment of people addicted to opioids, depriving the working poor, children, and people with disabilities of health care, and in the long run, removing funding for the care of elderly people in nursing homes. The Republican bill would have undone the expansion of Medicaid, which added 11 million low-income adults to the program and guaranteed the federal government would cover almost all their costs. It would have ended the federal government's open-ended commitment to pay a significant share of states' Medicaid costs, no matter how much enrollment or spending rose. Instead, the bill would have given the states a choice between a fixed annual sum per recipient or a block grant, both of which would have almost certainly led to major cuts in all coverage. The article is very specific about how the Trump administration was up against a firestorm, as in every one of their constituency, reactionary Republicans were confronted by their own constituents and were unwilling or unable to contain the anger and the determination of these constituents to hold them accountable for the consequences. Still, the Times says, last week's defeat reflected how hard it is to take away an entitlement. It showed how the broad, deep reach of Medicaid, which covers 6 times as many people as private marketplaces created under the ACA, has now found a constituency in a broad stretch of the American public. It provides medical care to 4 out of 10 American children. It covers the cost of nearly half of all births in the United States. It pays for the care of two-thirds of people in nursing homes, for 10 million children and adults with physical or mental disabilities, for states that accounts for 60% of federal funding, meaning that these cuts hurt not only the poor, but all children with autism or dying parents who are also going to be facing the consequences. This is a radical article without intending to be, because what it describes is a population that is rising up in response to the meaning of the politics that are being pursued, not just by the Republican Party, but the Democrats as well. It's a long and particularized and detailed article, and I suggest that everyone look at it, and we look at it with care, because it points the way to what our tasks are, how we mobilize, what we do, how we provide an engine of resistance and struggle that embraces the broad strata of population that is exploited by capitalism in the United States. It indicates that the so-called Freedom Caucus, which demanded to end the requirement that insurance plans provide essential benefits such as maternity, pediatric care, emergency services, ambulances, mental health coverage, rudiments of health care, and allow states to impose work requirements on any recipient of Medicaid. Federal state health plan that covers 74 million poor people to be ended and permits states to take their federal funds in the form of block grants and ending Medicaid as an entitlement program. But the Freedom Caucus also demanded the lifting of a ban on insurers denying coverage based on pre-existing health conditions, the elimination of a provision allowing people to remain covered by their parents' plan until 26, termination of a ban on the imposition of yearly or lifetime caps on insurance benefits, and the quashing of a requirement that insurers spend at least 80% of premiums on health care benefits of clients. Now, what is very particularly important about these articles is it delineates how Obamacare was designed to slash costs for the corporations and government and undermine employer-paid insurance and impose the burden of, and I'm quoting, the burden of extending bare-bones coverage to some 20 million previously uninsured people and impose it on working people as a whole. The split in the Republican ranks over the Trump-Ryan bill mirrored the split within the corporate elite. Major corporate lobbying groups, including those representing the hospital chains and doctors, had come out in opposition to the bill because of the consequences that come back and affect them as well. So what we're dealing with here is a readiness on the part of large sections of the nominal reactionary defenders of capital to back off under pressure and to back off under resistance. Both Trump and the Democrats signaled their readiness to collaborate in devising new means to slash health care benefits. Quote, when Obamacare explodes, Trump told the press, the Democrats will get together with us to work out a health care bill that we want, and I'm all for that. That's what they're attempting to sell us, but they're faced with an uprising which we can mobilize with a much larger agenda than the capitalist parties intend for us. The magnitude of the crisis of this system, which is only beginning to express itself, particularly as they prepare to cut the cost of corporate capital in all respects with the tax benefits that will benefit them at the expense of the mass of the population, is but the little beginning of a radicalization that will encompass vast sectors of the population. We have to speak to it, mobilize it, cohere it, and give it direction and lead it to a struggle for capitalism to fall and for power to fall within the hands of the population. Long overdue, our task, our mandate, our opportunity.
Thank you so much for that. And as I said earlier on in the program, it kind of reminds me of the Dred Scott decision and what happened after that. That is the government decision that if a slave left the South and went for a slave state and went to a free state, he was still slave property. And that was the law. But the law was defeated because they could not enforce it. The public rose up and said no. Too many sheriffs were being killed by local people when the sheriffs tried to enforce the Dred Scott decision. And so when New Haven, Connecticut, and Dallas, and Austin, Texas said, we're not going to follow that, when California said, we're not going to follow these federal laws, we're not going to support ICE, that to me was a representation of a rebellion of the people and how the government can be backed off And as you have said, Mr. Schoenman, we must take that and run with it. We must be inclusive, passionate about our being together and forming issues that and policies that we can organize together on to turn this corporate juggernaut around. Thank you for that, Sister Betty.
I want to now turn to someone who has helped us have integrity to our warriors behind the bars. And one needs to ask oneself, why do we end up with political prisoners? Well, one of the reasons we end up with political prisoners is they're willing to fight for us. And we have to admit the majority of mankind will not fight for itself. But there are always warriors who are willing to step in front and lead the charge. And sometimes they go down. And that's why we have political prisoners. The second thing we have to ask ourselves is, well, what are the political prisoners fighting for? Well, if you paid close attention and did your research on Larry Pinkney, who is a former political prisoner, you would know what the Black Panther Party fought for. You would know that among their points that they fought for our community was health, education, and housing. And in all three areas, we are at risk of genocide. So I want to call attention to Sister Ann Lamb, who has been steadfast in her support of political prisoners and their families. And I want you to know that it was the fight for a political prisoner who was suffering from Hep C that brought the issue of Hep C and the perfidy of the corporations in overcharging us for the medication for this vicious illness. Sister Ann Lamb, are you in the house? And can you update us on our beloved political prisoners?
I can update you on a couple. I've been seeing Jaleel an awful lot lately. I said, you know, what is this, the scenic tour? You know, first they moved him from Attica to Southport. We saw him there 3 weeks ago. Then they moved him from Southport to Shawangunk. We saw him there the last 2 weeks, really giving Jaleel a hard time. So we have a couple little letters from him, so and a little report from me. This is my little report from March 19th that I visited Jaleel at Shawangunk. When he was moved last Monday, meaning the Monday before the 19th, this is how they moved him. This is not a normal transfer. He was taken out on a medical for a stress test. Then instead of taking him out to Southport, they took him to Shawangunk. He asked to make a phone call to his lawyer, but was not allowed to do so. So he sent a legal letter to Bob Boyle, for which Docs has to provide the stamp. That's why we didn't find out he was moved until Friday. Since his transfer did not take place in the normal fashion, Jaleel doesn't know if he has any of his stuff. I have updates about that, too. He was upset because he wanted to send birthday greetings to his daughter, but he doesn't even have a stamp. Jaleel is scheduled to be returned to general population on March 21st, so hopefully he will be able to make phone calls. Please take the time to write to Jaleel and let him know he's in our hearts and on our minds. It would be really good for Jaleel to get a lot of correspondence at this time. Then I was sitting around last week getting extremely anxious because he didn't call, and I was like, now what's going on? These people are capable of anything, you know, as we well know. We have enough dead comrades to prove that. So I got a letter from him on the 24th that he had sent on the 22nd, and I was very relieved to get it last Friday night. He says, I'm out of shoe. However, phones, commissary, and packages won't be restored until March 29th. So here's yet another thing they're doing. They released him from SHU and placed, they released me from SHU and placed me in the Closed Supervision Unit, CSU, absent any notice or due process procedure. On the surface, prisoners are treated like all other prisoners, go to school, programs, recreation, etc., as all other prisoners do. But they're scrutinized more closely, searched more often, and they imagine reported on more frequently. I intend to file a FOIL request for all documents regarding the unit and the arbitrary and capricious decision to place me in the CSU. Once I get the documents, I'll file a grievance to exhaust administrative remedies and proceed with the petition in the court. Still haven't received my property, hopefully by the end of the week at the latest. Revolutionary love and unity, Jaleel. All right. So I went to see him last Sunday, and at least we were in the regular visiting room. We could actually give each other a hug. We could share some. I mean, we could share some food even when I visited him in the shoe, but they have this big plexiglass thing. You can, like, there's a little space on the bottom where you can put food through and, you know, at least, you know, grasp each other's hands. But, and the other interesting thing about Shawangunk, and I've never seen this in any other prison, we are not allowed to take notes. Okay, I'm there last Sunday. I have my little own paper, and I had a pencil because we were going to play Scrabble, right? He likes to play Scrabble. So I got the Scrabble board, and the Scrabble pieces is the way you get the pencil and the paper, right? And the CEO says to me, you can only have one piece of paper, and you have to give it back to me when you leave. So I was like, oh, you want to know our Scrabble scores? Right? But this is very strange. So I had, of course, my own little paper, and I was taking some notes underneath. And he came over at one point, and he said, you have another piece of paper. And I was like, I do not. You know, of course, I totally denied that I had another piece of paper. And he said, I want to make you empty your pockets when you leave. I was like, okay, I don't mind emptying my pockets. I don't have another piece of paper. Because, of course, I had it, but it wasn't in my pocket. But that's beside the point, what part of the point, you know, that you can't even take notes. Because I checked with Sekou Odinga, who is now out. We were speaking on the phone yesterday, because he was in Chuangong for a while. And he says, yes, I remember that day. We tried to take notes one time, and they did the same thing. So that's special to Chuangong. And then I just got another letter from Jaleel dated March 26. So I won't go into the whole thing, but unfortunately, not all of my personal property has been received, and the officer informed that two bags are missing. He says they may come next week, and they may not, right? Radio, fan, lamp, books, shirts, food, prayer rug, Quran, headphones, all 7 photo albums, 2 chess sets, 45 stamps, etc., not arrived and presumed, quote-unquote, stolen, lost. This is because they didn't do the normal transfer when you go with your property and you're moved, right? So he says, I filed a claim and will also file a grievance on how I'm being transferred without the opportunity to inventory my personal property. Just as devastating, my typewriter arrived broken. The carriage won't move. So I'm sending it out to be repaired or replaced. I'm sending it to Burning Books and have them get the repairs or replacement done. Please tell Leslie or Nate that they should expect it to be arriving within the next couple of weeks. I will write them to explain the problem and how to get it fixed. If it is necessary to replace, we'll need to initiate a fundraising effort because it costs $350 for a new one. Then he apologizes by asking me to type up all these things, which I certainly do not mind doing. It's an honor and a privilege to type anything for any of these prisoners. Since I'm not able to type, I hope you don't mind typing the enclosed proposal that I want to send to Governor Cuomo, which is extremely interesting. You can type it and send me a copy, but sign his name to the original and send return receipt requested to his office. And he also just wrote another piece called Cognitive Dissonance, which is very interesting, which I also have to type and get up on the website. So he says, I know lately I've inundated you with stuff. I sincerely hope it hasn't become burdensome. No, it has not. But for me, the beginning of 2017 has been terrible. I can only hope by summer a more hopeful reality will emerge and prevail. So he's already borrowed stamps from people. He asked me to get in touch with a few people. But he's talking again about this closed supervision unit. I've been assigned to reside in the closed supervision unit upon my release from SHU. In 1991-94, when I was here, I was not held in the CSU, but I think Herman was when he was here. I've since filed a FOIL about being held in this unit, the selection process, absent a due process notice, and or the method to be released and have this designation removed from my file. Also, I've written to prisoners' legal services to learn anything they may have concerning the justification for assigning prisoners to this unit. Okay? So the other interesting news in this letter is when he first got to Chuangong, there are several COs who know him from before. So when back in 94, he was the prisoner grievances, you know, coordinator. So he was telling the staff at that time, you know, there's a lot of grievances here. You really should take care of this. You know, you're going to end up having a problem, which, of course, they interpreted as like a threat, right? So it was this Officer Van Pelt, who was still there. He just found out he's still there in the property room, who actually killed an inmate in 1994. Okay, this guy still has his job and his pension, right? He killed somebody, all right? I don't know the exact circumstances, but then at that time, Jaleel said everybody went on strike, everybody stayed in their cells, refused to work, and this other CO who is now a lieutenant named Gardner, and another CO who is now a sergeant named North, designated Jaleel as the person who, you know, instigated all this. He was the person who instigated the strike, and that's how he got shipped to Auburn, where he was for a long time until 2011 when they took him to Attica. And when he gets there, these people, the three of them, well, he didn't know about Van Pelt until he went to get his property. But the other two were busy, you know, doing verbal harassment constantly. When I went to see him, not this past week, but the week before when he was still in the shoe, because he told me, you know, this guy, North, was up in the SHU on a Wednesday evening at 6:30, where he has no reason to be whatsoever. It's not his assignment. It's not his shift. Standing outside Jaleel's cell, you know, hey, you got old, you know, all this kind of stuff.
Oh, so, and I'm going to cut into you there. As
I
have
know it's
a letter.
But, I know you have a lot of things to do.
I have a letter from Jaleel, which I will read one line from. It is my sincere hope that this finds you in the very best of health and strong in spiritual recovery from your loss. Jaleel, and he signed in the spirit of Nelson Mandela in apartheid New York State prison system. So he is strong, and so we must be equally strong. And so I'm going to turn it over to Sister Betty for our next guest.
I see Brother Nat still hung in there with us, and he seems to be on a different line. So a little bit later in the program, we're going to try and click back on and see if some of those technical difficulties have cleared up. And I thank him for coming back on another line. But in the meantime, we're going to go to Brother Tom, and we hope that he is in the house. Brother Tom.
Hi, everybody. You know, I'm a big believer in knowing about history.
Yes.
And I often wonder, well, what about my own history? Where did I, how did I wind up as a radical? And New Haven was mentioned. Well, it just so happens that my family, they come from New York City, working class people. They moved to New Haven when I was 2 years old, and I went to elementary and junior high school in New Haven. I lived in a working class neighborhood in a three family building that happened to be owned by communists. I didn't know what a communist was, but somehow I think that somehow it rubbed off on me, and I think that's where my radicalism started to take seed. Now, I would like to quote from a very famous American, and I would like to know if any of you have any idea who this person is. Quote, "Inasmuch as most good things are produced by labor, it follows that all such things of right belong to those whose labor has produced them. But it has so happened in all ages of the world that some have labored and others have, without labor, enjoyed most of the fruits of that labor. This is wrong and should not continue. To secure to each laborer the whole product of his labor is the most worthy object of any good government." Now, who do you think said that? Famous
American.
Read
it. I've read it, but I do not remember. Excuse my senior citizen mind, but give us the answer.
Well, most people would be would not have any idea that this person would say such a thing. It was Abraham Lincoln.
Oh, say yes.
Now,
yes.
Here we have a man who says something like that, but he never was for the abolition of slave labor. Until it became painfully obvious to him that the North was losing the Civil War and that tens of thousands of slaves were fleeing into Union lines, and he couldn't return them to the rebel states. And so he issued an Emancipation Proclamation just affecting the rebel states, not affecting the rest of the nation. And so here is an example of a person who has a blind spot in his thinking regarding something that he might have said, which sounds great. Another a great example, you all know this, is Thomas Jefferson's famous writing that all men are created equal, that they endowed with certain inalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, I saw a movie a couple of days ago. I highly recommend it. It's a documentary on James Baldwin, I Am Not Your Negro.
Right.
And he pointed out that most whites are in deep denial, and they suffer from a mythical interpretation of the history of this country, from the story of the Pilgrims. To what the American Revolution was really about, to the pioneers' spirit going out west, to the Civil War, and all the wars that this country has engaged in, this notion of American exceptionalism and democracy, and to the belief that nowadays, racism and xenophobia are on the decline. Now, another notion that most Americans suffer from is that the Democratic Party is more progressive than the Republican Party, that they are less racist than the Republicans. But the main difference between the Trump regime and the Clinton and Obama regimes is that Trump and his cohorts openly state that they do not believe in climate change, and that that Mexicans and Muslims are a grave threat to our Anglo-Saxon culture, and that we must engage them in a war or build a wall to keep them out. In other words, the Republicans pull no punches. But the Democrats, however, are the true hypocrites. They would never come out and say these things, but their economic foreign policies are the same. That is,
thank you for saying that. I said thank you for saying that, brother. Right on. Make it plain, bro. Go ahead. This is Larry.
These two corporate parties are really the same, to protect capitalism and to engage in imperialism. Now, James Baldwin pointed out that blacks, the indigenous, recent immigrants, they're all fully aware of the myth of America, but that the majority of whites, are they ready to reject this myth and build a new America, a society based upon true equality? Sister Lynn Stewart showed us that there are whites who can overcome their prejudices. But unless the white majority faces up to our history and overcomes its prejudices, and this is what Baldwin says, and I tend to agree with him, unless this happens, this nation will descend into a bloody civil war.
Yes, Tom, I agree with that. And what has happened, there has a war on people of color. They called it a war on... It was never a war on drugs, and I have many funny stories that I could tell you about that. And the other thing about your presentation was that when Thomas Jefferson and those who had defined words, Lynn and I often laughed when we read that he retired to the hard work of maintaining his plantation. And we laugh and say they didn't mention those who did the hard work. And so America has always been a place of double standard. The truth was not told, but we see the truth is being understood, acted upon now. And let us remember that the Democratic Party in East Orange, New Jersey, supported the Fraternal Order of Police, that group that Trump met with today. They supported the Democrats in East Orange, New Jersey. Democrats of color followed the dictates of the Fraternal Order of Police, made a phone call, and had a teacher fired for allowing her students to write postcards to Mumia Abu-Jamal. Yes, they are the same people, and let us be aware that no people can be oppressed without the connivance of their own. We got a lot of connivers, but I'm going to let it go with that. Sister Betty.
Before we go to Brother Richie, who's hanging in the wings, we want to try our poet one more time to see if that technical difficulty has been cleared up. So, Brother Nat, we're opening up your mic on 1446. Number
okay. 1446. Is that better? Does that work?
Much better. Can hear you loud
great,
and clear.
Yeah.
Okay, so I've been thinking a lot about Brother Ralph and the family, and also Sister Betty and all the other people who were around Lynn. And I've been trying to work on this piece. I'm still trying to work it out and feel like I can get it to a place where it's befitting of someone of her stature. I'm so proud to just be a part of your circle. And there's a line, believe it, of all places in The Godfather where he says, we just didn't get enough time. We just didn't have enough time. And that's the way I feel. But anyway, this piece is the piece that I did at the wake called Valedictorian. I'm going to just try it again. Valedictorian.
Yeah.
Instruction in youth is like engraving in stone. That's a Moroccan quote. Did you say I've got a lot to learn? Well, don't think I'm trying not to learn. Since this is a perfect spot to learn, why don't you come on and teach me tonight? Starting with the ABC of it, roll it right down to the XYZ of it. Help me solve the mystery of it. We wake with watch hands saying different things, yet saying nothing untrue at 9, at 10, 11, round midnight, or 4 in the morning. Our valedictorian left the long table, checked out, crossed crimson curtains, slipped through silk membrane, sacred ancestral space, but never quietly into the night. Never far away, winking from the galaxy, delivering stellar 77-page commencement addresses, forging links in chains of struggle, never bowing down or sucking up, flipping tassel, flinging mortarboard skyward, signaling us to mourn as needed, hang tears out to dry, signaling us to step up, strap-on balls, take Mama Harriet hormones, speak truth to classes, entering from colleges of struggle, universities of the street, signaling us to become distinguished professors of Lynn Stewart studies, unpacking, decontextualizing intersectionalities of socialism, hardwiring our hearts with happiness, joy, love, erecting lives worth living, signaling us to become distinguished professors of Lynn Stewart studies, shameless agitators having yes men fun, dancing in the street to brass bands, single pair juju masters caring for all, anonymous WikiLeaks workers whispering what's real. Lynn Stewart scholars, come matriculate, come agitate, come with love trumping hate, come educate with fear scorching debate, come quickly blowing whistles on some gate, come shredding scribblers who obfuscate, for we know we can win with readers like Lynn, with leaders like Lynn. We know we can win with writers like Lynn, with fighters like Lynn. We know we can win with lawyers like Lynn, with warriors like Lynn.
Thank you so much. You lifted me up. I hope it lifts up others. And thanks again. See you the 22nd and everyone else on the 22nd. And from 3 to 7 at St. Peter's Church on 54th and Lenox. Lexington Avenue. And see you soon. And with that, Sister Betty.
All right. We want to open up our mic for Richie. And then we need to have an open discussion, if there's time, about what that decision that came down from involving Mamiya's health means. Okay, Brother Richie, your mic is open.
Hello, everybody. Happy birthday, Ralph, again.
Hey,
and
thank
many
you
more.
For that.
I have your birthday card ready for you on the 22nd.
Okay,
I have it ready for you, and hopefully some nice vegan desserts for you that I think you'll enjoy, fat-free.
Okay.
Can't forget your birthday, of course. And I just wanted to read something about the Haymarket martyrs who were hung and Lucy Parsons, because we should have had more people at Lynn's memorial. There should have been hundreds of thousands of people there compared to what Lynn has done in her life. And we have to change that. We have to have our heroes, while they're living, recognized, not wait till they pass away. And I think I'd like to read something that happened to one of the Haymarket martyrs that were hung to try and fight for the 8-hour working day and for revolution. They said, according to the Chicago Daily News, 10,000 people came to join the family of George Engel, who sat at home playing cards when the Haymarket bomb exploded. No evidence linked him to it. Nevertheless, he died on the gallows on November 11, 1887. The following day, his body, along with that of Louis Ling, lay in state in the back room of the modest toy store that the Engels had run since 1876. And I thought I'd read one more thing and then just leave one comment. The world today, you're obligated to pretend respect for people and institutions you think absurd. You live attacked in a cowardly fashion through moral and social conventions you despise, condemn, and lack all foundation. It is that permanent contradiction between your ideas and desires and all the dead formalities and vain pretenses of your civilization which makes you sad, troubled, and unbalanced. In that intolerable conflict, You lose all joy of life and all feeling of personality, or you might become a liberal, because at every moment or poverty pit, they suppress and restrain and check the free play of your powers. That's the poison and mortal wound of the civilized world. 1899, these are part of the comments when the Haymarket martyrs were hung. But you know what? When they killed Zacco Manzetti, there were 100,000 people at the memorial in Massachusetts. Well, we need to have, because all the people on the left who aren't revolutionaries, they're just waiting to put the next Democrat in.
Right.
That's all they're waiting for, to change nothing. And we have to start that now to say, and we should call this Turtle Island, which we keep forgetting. And I'm not trying to resurrect the government. I'm trying to get rid of it. We need to get Dr. Shakur out, to get these free health clinics. And my desire is to start a prevention health clinic so that people can live there, they can teach there, and they can educate the neighborhoods on what's really going on, because we have everybody scattered in these prisons, in these dungeons, being tortured by what we call fake doctors. And I just wanted to say, we should question doctors. We question everything else. And please, let's not do chemotherapy. Let's eat organic foods, drink organic orange juice, exercise, and we'll never get cancer.
Okay, thank you so much for that, Richie. And I will be sure to connect with you to get my vegan dessert. But finally, I would like to read a message from the Info Free Momia. And it's urgent, a great update on Momia and Hep C treatment. He still needs your help. Today at 1:59 p.m. Good news. Today, March 27th, the Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit denied the Department of Corrections motion to stay. Denied Department of Corrections motion to stay Judge Mariani's order that the Department of Correction provide Momia the Hep C treatment pending appeal. The DOC had filed a motion that saying that until the appeal is decided, they need not comply. The
right.
Appeals court has now rejected that argument. And so this does not mean that the DAC, Department of Corrections, will comply and treat Momia as soon as possible. We don't know what they will try next. There has been a motion pending in front of Mariani for almost 2 months to find the DOC in contempt for failing to comply with his order to treat Momia. Momia's lawyers, Bob Boyle and Brett Grody, are consulting to figure out the next step. Meanwhile, this is indeed a great victory, but Momia has not been treated yet. Protests, pressure, and publicity are needed to get Momia and other prisoners Hep C treatment. And understand this, it is not only a question of prisoners, not only a question of political prisoners, it's a question of the people here. And as Lynn said, we're not charged or convicted with anything who are not getting Hep C treatment. And now that brings us to the whole question of health care, single-payer health care. As was outlined earlier in this program, the Affordable Care Act kept the corporations in the business of health and in making money. And so we must continue our struggle along with our political prisoners to get decent health care for them and decent health care for ourselves, decent housing. And I see Sister Betty is reaching for the microphone. Sister
I just
Betty.
Wanted to remind all of our panelists that our beloved and late Sister Mary Neal was fighting for the mentally ill. And one of the cases she talked about was a man in Florida who was literally boiled to death in his cell so that his flesh was on the floor. The officers did that, killed this man by boiling him alive, were recently released without any charges. This is Florida that just removed a black politician for trying to do away with the death penalty. This
Absolutely.
Is Florida with more death penalties for black people than any other state in America. I think we need a revolution.
I think
Thank
so,
you.
Too.
Thank you so much for that, Betty, and I believe we are...
That's time.
Our book can be
Okay, keep your eyes closed.
Okay.
I want to show you my first ever painting.
All right.
Okay. Open your eyes.
Oh, that's a lot of colors and shapes.
So be honest. What do you think?
Well, I like how if you switch to Geico, you could save hundreds of dollars on car insurance.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Here, why don't I hold your paintbrush while you call them?
Geico, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.
Dunkin' Donuts iced coffee is America's iced coffee. It's rich, smooth, always freshly brewed. Dunkin' has all the flavors you love. Also available in butter pecan and new coconut cream pie iced coffee flavors. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer. Dunkin' Donuts' new fruited iced teas are made with real fruit juice and fruit pieces. Try a mango, pineapple, or blackberry today. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer.